I do have one more sheet after this, and then we've got a whole bunch of scriptures that we're going to be spending some time, and I don't know how long it'll take us to go through those, but I want to get through this next these next couple sheets in the next couple weeks, hopefully. But
what sheet is this that you're on?
We're on 10-11. 10-11,
okay.
Do you need a 10-11?
I don't know. I couldn't find mine. I cleaned up my house.
Well, you know, I do have some 10-11s left.
I don't really know.
I have a 10 left. There we go. That's what I have. See if I have another one. I don't. Oh, thank you. I didn't have to get up. What we're doing right now is we moved last week into looking at the Arminian model. There were, remember, there are two guys on either side of the eternal security issue primarily, because most theology falls into two guys, people that follow John Calvin. Even though we call them reformers, it's less about following Luther than it is about following John Calvin, or people that follow Jacob Arminius. Jacob Arminius was a reformer, and he was a Calvinist, but he modified his Calvinism because of other doctrinal issues that were going on in the region where he was at, primarily issues that had to do with who Jesus Christ was and such, and that's a whole other set of studies to go on. And though they were wrong things that were happening, but he modified it, and in modifying it, he ended up going to the direction that he ended up teaching. That a Christian, if a Christian doesn't persevere in believing, they can lose their salvation. So last week, what we did was, and we're doing the same, following the same path we followed when we were looking at the Reform model and how it affects this. And that is that we looked at God, then we looked at the effect of the doctrine on the church and the effect of the doctrine on future things. All three of those things being things that connect in some way with our understanding of eternal security. And so last week we started looking at their view of the doctrine of God, and we talked about the fact that they have a view that God is omniscient and all-powerful, but that, as this one writer has here, God limits his control. That is, that God can control everything, but he limits it. There are some extremists within the Arminian system today that believe that they teach what's called open theism, that is, that God is not omniscient, that God knows or learns things at the same time we know it. In other words, I picked up my pen right there. God just figured out that I was going to pick up my pen when I just did that. He hasn't known from all eternity I was going to do that. And the same thing then is obviously true of salvation. God only knows who's going to be saved when they actually believe the gospel. And the reason they do that is not biblical. They base that on a philosophical argument that says, in order for you to be really true, or in order for you to be really free, that act cannot be determined. In fact, it can't even be known. If God knows about the act a billion years or a thousand years or one day before you do it, then knowing it makes it set in stone. Therefore, it's not really free, because it has to be free at the very instant you do it that it couldn't have been determined. Picking something up, choosing God, so it's a philosophical argument. So they then also, so then what we, this is what we're looking at last week, what we started into, was looking at scriptures that said, is God in control or not? Should be a question mark after the not, and then a capital T, the scriptures presented. So we're looking at scriptures which present God as changing or unknowing. From their point of view, that's what these are their list of scriptures, not some that I came up with, but a list that various writers had that I culled from different writings that they had, where they're trying to say that God changes or God does not know everything. And last week we looked at two. We looked at Genesis 6 and we looked at Genesis 22. We're going to go over to Exodus chapter 4. Now I'm going to continue doing what we did last week. We're going to read the passage and then I'm going to just ask you, tell me what you think is going on in the passage. In other words, I want to see if you can follow what's happening and you could give an answer. If somebody was presenting this to you and said, oh, look, here's a verse that says God doesn't know everything or God changes, how would you answer this verse? That's what I want to know. And you don't all have to give an answer every time, but at least maybe one or two of you can try to help us. So in Exodus chapter 4 and let's go to verse 1. Then Moses answered and said, what if they will not believe me or listen to what I say? For they may say, the Lord has not appeared to you. And the Lord said to him, what is that in your hand? And he said, it is a staff. And then he said, throw it on the ground. So he threw it on the ground, and it became a serpent. And Moses fled from it. And the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand and grasp it by its tail. So he stretched out his hand, caught it, and it became a staff in his hand. That they may believe that the Lord, the God of their fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has appeared to you. Now the verse they use is in verse 2 in that set. They had all those listed, but verse 2 is the one they point to, where God asks Moses the question, what is that in your hand? Now, how would you answer that? Their statement is, God said, Moses, what do you got there? I don't know what you have. How would you answer that?
For Moses, he's going to do a miracle with it, so he asks that question, so he knows that it's a physical staff. It'll become a spiritual symbol.
Okay. In other words, very in simple terms, God is not asking Moses because God doesn't know what's in his hand. I mean, now some of these might press us a little bit, but this is one of the ones where you look at it. If you're like me, you look at it and you say, I'd have to be incredulous to really think that God didn't know what was in Moses' hand. Anybody standing there should be able to know what he was holding in his hand. But this shows you, and this is maybe a good lesson for us, that sometimes we can be so desperate to press or push our point of view or something that we believe that we will sometimes press a text beyond its natural meaning, what is natural to it. Obviously, they do that. Now, the second one that we come to then is that God gave multiple signs in the event that they didn't believe from the previous signs. Now, let's see. We're on here in Exodus chapter 4. Go down to verse 8 and 9. It says, and it shall come about that if they will not believe you or heed the witness of the first sign, then they may believe the witness of the last sign. But if they shall not believe even these two signs or heed what you say, then you shall take some water from the Nile and pour it on the dry ground. And the water which you take from the Nile will become blood on the dry ground. Their point being, God said, I've got a sign for you, Moses, but I don't know if that one will work. If that one doesn't work, then we're going to try another sign. And if that one doesn't work, then I've got this third sign. And they state the case that they believe that this sign is saying God wasn't particularly sure if any of these signs would work. How would you answer that? Wants to venture a guess?
I will. I don't want to jump everybody else's.
Go ahead.
God obviously knows what's going to happen, but Moses doesn't know what's happening, and God's not telling Moses everything's going to happen. Moses has to do some things by faith. So God gives him some options of what to be thinking about, but he doesn't give Moses all the answers anymore than he gives us all the answers to every single thing that's going to happen in our lives. So Moses has to go one step at a time, just like we do in our life.
Okay. Are you done?
Yeah.
Okay, I didn't want to cut you off. I started. I thought you were going on. I thought I was cutting you off. So. No, that's quite all right. One of the other things that actually is stated in here when God ends up talking to Moses and he's going to send him before Pharaoh, he's going to tell him, and it's going to be repeated again and again and again, that he is going to harden Pharaoh's heart. And I don't even have these on here because this was not the main thing I was trying to deal with. But here's an example. Chapter 7 and verse 3. Turn to Exodus chapter 7 verse 3. I was just looking because I know I've got all these marked in my Bible. I just wanted to see if I could find. Yeah, there's another one. Okay. Verse 3. Jehovah says, but I will harden Pharaoh's heart that I may multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. Now, this actually is exactly what Jim is just telling us. God says, I want to multiply my signs. I want to do this. Verse 4, so that when Pharaoh will not listen to you, then I will lay my hand in Egypt and bring out my host, my people, the sons of Israel, from the land of Egypt by great judgment. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand on Egypt and bring out the sons of Israel from their midst. He wanted the Egyptians to know this. Now, they're not the only ones. He also wanted Israel to know. I'm the one that delivered you. I'm the one that did these things. It's not that Pharaoh was a nice guy. And so he says he's going to harden his heart, and that word that's used there is actually to make it hard like flint, but that's the only one that's used like that. If you look in verse 13 of the same chapter, we have another word that's translated, and your Bibles might translate it differently, but it says, yet Pharaoh's heart was hardened. And this is repeated throughout here, and it's always... always has the idea of to make it strong. In other words, when God even does this to Pharaoh, it's because Pharaoh wants, back up, Pharaoh did not want to let Israel go. And when Pharaoh, because pressure was getting, was going to weenie out, essentially, put it in good slang, he was going to give up. Okay, I'll give in. I don't want to take it anymore. God actually, literally with the Hebrew word kasak, was going to make his heart strong so that he wouldn't give in and he'd do what he wanted to do. In other words, I would assert Pharaoh didn't want to let him go. So when God hardens Pharaoh's heart, God is not making Pharaoh make a choice Pharaoh doesn't want to make.
He gives him resolve.
He does. He just gives strength to his heart, strengthens his resolve, precisely what he's doing, so that he, in those situations, holds out so God can do all 10 of the plagues he wants to perform, so that he can demonstrate that he brought him out. Okay, Exodus chapter 32. Exodus chapter 32.
It's evident too, because God wasn't the only one that hardened Pharaoh's heart. Sometimes Pharaoh hardened his own heart, which proves that that was what his intention was. It wasn't just God making him go against his grain. He really wanted to do it because he hardened his own heart.
Precisely, yeah. And you have to, and it's always interesting, you should look back and forth through those, the ones between, it says when God hardened his heart and when Pharaoh hardened his heart. Precisely, thank you. Exodus 32, then in verse 9. Now this is the incident in which there was, Moses had been up on the mountain, had been gone an extended time. They said, they told Aaron, we don't know where this Moses is. And they said, make gods for us. And Aaron says, okay, bring me your jewelry. And of course, they cast it, and he fashions it, makes it into a golden calf, and they essentially end into a very improper orgy, is actually what it is. And we're told that in some of the other passages, what they were doing. And so then it goes on, and it tells us then, beginning in verse 9, and the Lord said to Moses, I have seen this people. Behold, they are an obstinate people. Now let me alone, that my anger may burn against them, and that I may destroy them, and I will make you a great nation. And then Moses entreated the Lord and said, O Lord, why does your anger burn against your people, whom you have brought out from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent he brought them out, to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger. Change your mind about doing harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants to whom you did swear by yourself and did say to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heaven, and also this land of which I have spoken I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever. So the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people. And then, of course, we end up knowing what ends up happening to with regard to Moses in the context. But the question that comes out in this passage, when you're looking at this, is, God was going to do this thing. God was going to destroy Israel. And Moses persuades God not to. So here's a place where God says, I'm going to do this, and then Moses changes his mind. And it plainly tells you in here, verse 14, so Jehovah changed his mind. And we have the same thing, the same statement made back up in... it was back up here in the context, and I'm not seeing it right now. Oh, back up in verse 12. Turn from your burning anger and change your mind, Moses says to him. So, again, the Arminians go, see, God changes his mind. Well, we had one of these last week in Genesis 6. But how would you answer that? in this context? What's with everything that's happening? Most of us know this story. Well, okay, if nobody has a suggestion on there.
I was going to say he was testing Moses.
That's...
Like a New Testament word, dokimos, he was wanting to approve Moses, approve Moses' character. He said Moses is the meekest man of the earth. He kept his focus, and God was allowing Moses a chance to prove that he had a correct estimation of Moses' character.
That's right. And to me, remember, one of the things that...
God wasn't doing that just so he could prove himself to God. Was there spirit beings watching also?
Spirit beings would be watching, yes.
But, I mean, God knew how Moses would react.
Mm-hmm. And
but it's for the benefit of Moses or others?
I would say for everybody else that reads the text, for people that read this, because the rest of the people of Israel, they didn't see this go on up there. The only way they knew about this was that God had Moses write down the event that took place in this.
The other thing is, God knows he's going to move Moses into leadership. In fact, later in this chapter, as a result, Moses kind of bends God's, not bends, Moses prays and God responds to it. But then later, God uses Moses to lead a slaughter of all those that basically worship the calf, right? He comes back and he basically says, all the Levites kind of rally, and he basically takes them through and kills like brother and neighbor. So it's like, I don't know, God knew he was going to be moving Moses in the leadership too, and he would need somebody who was going to pray on behalf of his people and lead his people. It's like with my, not the same, but like with my wrestling captains, man, I expect a certain something out of them, you know, and you don't get that by always leading for them. They've got to learn it themselves, and I mean, maybe that's an overestimation of the scripture, but you know, Moses is going to be a big-time leader, and he's going to have to make some tough decisions to follow God.
Look at verse 12. Look at verse 12 there, and you tell me, who do you think Moses is concerned for? When you read verse 12. Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them?
For God's
I think that is one of the key things to look at in here is that Moses is concerned for the reputation of God in this. He's not just going, this is my family, this is my kin, you know. These are my fellow Israelites. You can't do this to them. Actually, in the context here, Moses is, I would say, at least as concerned for God's reputation that if you do this, what's this going to say to the Egyptians? What's this going to say to these other people? That you brought them out with your power. You did all this. That's very impressive. But then you just brought them out here and wiped them out? Mm-hmm. And so I would say that, yeah, it's demonstrating that Moses understands what God's objective is in this. And he is, as Jim was pointing out, God calls Moses the meekest man that was upon the earth at that time. Moses had a focus and a control of mind where he said, this is the objective we're going. And even though the fact that he's got this nation, this huge nation, all these people that are with him and everything, and they're giving him trouble and grief. And it's, you know, when you read through Exodus and you read through these books, it's just time and again that these people get themselves into trouble and get themselves into trouble and get themselves into trouble despite what Moses says. And I could honestly at times understand, I would have been Moses, I would have said, God, do away with them. I am tired of this. Because this isn't the first time Moses has had to deal with problems with these people. These problems even started before they reached Sinai. This is after Sinai, but before they even reached Sinai. Remember, God says, I'm going to send you food out there. And they go out, but you have to get enough for the seventh day of the manna on the sixth day, because there's not going to send any. And what does Moses write down? But on the seventh day, there were some that were out there that were looking. And then he tells them never to keep any overnight. And he says, and there were some that kept it overnight, and overnight it went bad, went rancid. And from the Hebrew term that he uses here, apparently when this stuff went rancid, this smelled bad. It's like if you ever had something sat in your refrigerator too long, you open your refrigerator like, oh. We had something that happened to us this last beginning of the week that we'd let sit in there. Just one day too long. Day before, okay. Next day, whoa, we had to get it out of the fridge. Apparently that's what happened. God, in other words, God did that because he wanted to get it through to them. You're going to do it my way. You're going to do it my way. So I wouldn't say in there, I think when you come down to verse 14, and this is, they accuse us saying this is a cheap way out. But in verse 14, when it says, so the Lord changed his mind, we'd call that an anthropomorphism. In other words, God is describing himself in human terms. God didn't really change his mind. God intended to bring the people of Israel out. He intended all the time to do this. So we'd say, well, then he's misleading Moses? Is he lying because he's not really? But God does things like this, and it's not lying because he's not really trying to deceive a person. He's got another purpose here that he's checking out. And I can think of one with a person. We would never say that he lied or tried to deceive anybody. But when Jesus meets the two disciples on the road to Emmaus, as they approach the town where those two disciples are from, what does it say Jesus did? He pretended as if he were going to continue on down the road. He didn't reach that, shall we say, that Y in the road and then going, hey, I'm going to follow you guys into town here. He pretended like he was going to go another way, really to see these two guys that he's been telling them all these things, beginning from Moses through the prophets, all these things in the Old Testament that were true about him, to see, are these guys want more? And these guys, oh, come home with us. It's late in the day. Come have a meal with us, which is what they did. So I would say God's not lying. He's not trying to deceive, but he's putting out a scenario or a situation to offer as a test for the character. Okay.
There's another, I guess it would go along with that, but it seems to me something I've thought about in the past is that God's character is in some ways quite simple. You know, he's not a complex being. He's made of spirit substance, and we talk about seven attributes that he has, one of which is truth. And the New Testament says that he can't do anything. He can't deny himself. He can't lie. And so it's almost as if God there is showing that we have the right to expect him to be exactly who he is. And if he's a God of truth and he's made promises, even if God himself offers to go against his promise, we have the right to expect him to keep his word. And I can't imagine standing before God himself and God saying, I'm going to do this, and arguing against him, like Abraham and Sodom and Gomorrah, or Moses here saying, no, you can't do that, Lord. But at the same time, God was basically offering to break his word that he made promises to Israel. He says, okay, I'll break this word. And Moses had a right to expect him to be consistent with his character.
Sure. In fact, it's interesting. This is towards the beginning of the Old Testament, at the other end of the Old Testament, the book of Malachi. After God goes through a litany of Israel's failures and transgressions of the law, he says, but you're not destroyed. And he says, I, Jehovah, do not change. Therefore, you are not destroyed. He says, if I changed, I might have given up on you by now. And remember, we took 2 years going through the minor prophets. And for some people, that was way too long and too much detail. But nonetheless, one of the things we saw again and again and again was that Israel failed, but God fulfilled exactly what he told Israel in his law and his promises. And the last of those prophets was Malachi. And when he talks through Malachi, God is saying, listen, because I am faithful, I do not change, you are not destroyed. The promises I made to you, despite everything you've done, you're still here because of my character.
It could be similar to the New Testament. God saying, you know, I decided I'm not going to make you blameless after all. I know we said that, but the church is so messed up, I've decided not to. It would be perfectly in keeping for us to say, but you promised that we would be to the praise of your glory. And if you neglect to do that, then your glory is going to suffer. Not because we're not going to get a benefit, but the thing is God's not being true to his own opinion of himself by doing that. Yeah, I would see that as a similar type.
Yep. Oh, yeah. Okay, 1 Samuel.
Exodus 33. Yeah, it's like, God's different, though, in the sense that, like, Lindsay, you know, as parents, Lindsay and I, we have authority over our kids, right? So, like, for instance, a couple days ago, do you remember, Kylie needed to go to the bathroom, and she said, Potty, and I wasn't fast enough. She was kind of moving, and she stood right by the toilet, and she just wet her pants. And anyway, so I went there and cleaned it up. And anyways, long story short, so I went in there, and Kenya asked me, she said, what did Kylie do? And I said, well, she didn't quite make it. But it's my fault. She was saying, potty, gotta. They said, go potty, then go potty. But I just didn't hustle her over there, you know. And so, Kaleman, anyways, he's in the doorway, and I'm telling Kenya, she went potty, and I don't know, Kale thought maybe I said, Kylie needs to come over here, and he just went, poof. Remember that? He pushed Kylie, bam, he just knocked her over. And so in the authority position, I said, Kale, you know, he knew I was mad. I was like, Kale, go to your room. And so he went to his room, and then got Kylie cleaned up everything. And so then I went in there, and I told him what, you know, we had a conversation about what he did wrong. And Kale's going to get a spank, and I know he said he's going to crawl up on my lap. Which is, that's never really fun, is it, bud? And so, you know, we were getting ready to do something, though. What's the deal we were going to hold him out of if he...
They wanted to watch a movie.
Oh, yeah, they wanted to watch a show, right. And so, sometimes, you know, he does stuff like that, it's like... But I wanted to see how you'd respond. You know, so I have the authority to go, hey, the other two kids are going to watch a show, and you're not because you pushed your sister. So anyways, I talked it through, and he thought that I had told Kenya that I wanted Kylie, you know, he didn't quite hear it all. He thought I said something about Kylie, get over there. So sometimes he's like, you need to go over there. And he gave him a little shove. But he, you know, I gave him the spanking, and sometimes he crawls into a corner, and he's like, oh, and he blows up. He didn't blow up, he just took it, and he goes, okay, Dad, you know, he was apologetic, he went there, and he apologized to his sister, and I said, okay, you know, I wanted to see how you'd respond before I made my decision of what I was going to do. You responded really well, you listened, you apologized to your sister, you didn't whine after your spanking, so, you know, you still have the right to watch the movie. So that's my authority. I can look over the whole thing, and I can decide. And I don't have to have my decision made up. I'm not omniscient, though, right? So, just playing the other side of the coin, and that's what you're doing tonight, Tim, with these questions. If you look at Exodus 33 and verse 3, that's just to jump into the context. In the NIV, it says, go up to the land flowing with milk and honey, but I will not go with you because you're a stiff-necked people, and I might destroy you on the way. And this is sometimes like, you know, Lindsay's like, you need to take Kale because I will... beat his buns off if I have to hold him too much longer, right?
I'll edit that out.
Yeah. That's good. But I think, you know, it's not like, I mean, the other side would say, look, God can't even be near him because he's afraid he's just going to fly off the handle. Verse 4, and then 5 would be the last one. Verse 4, when the people heard these distressing words, they began to mourn, and no one put on any ornaments. So I think they're kind of, you know, down in the face a little bit. Verse 5, and for the Lord had said to Moses, tell the Israelites, you're a stiff-necked people. If I were to go with you for even a moment, I might destroy you. Now take off your ornaments, and I will decide what to do with you. This is just another one of those scriptures to me that, you know, on the other side it says, look, God's not omniscient all the way. I mean, he's still trying to decide. You know, the difference is I have the ability to decide as I play things out. Because I don't know the future. I don't know how Kel's going to respond. I don't know if he's going to blow up and I can say, hey, I already know you're not getting the movie or the show or whatever it was because I know you're going to blow up. But it's like God says these things out loud so that they get to hear it. You know? Like, he's omniscient. You know, he's all-knowing. But he's still saying it. It's nice because it gives us better dialogue, but I don't know. I mean, I don't know if other people would say, look, he's still trying to figure out himself what he's going to do.
And interesting enough, if you keep on reading, go down to verse 12, and you actually have a similar thing to what just happened in the last chapter. And then Moses said to the Lord, seeing you say to me, bring up this people, but you yourself have not let me know whom you will send with me. Moreover, you have said, I have known you by name, and you have also found favor in my sight. Now, therefore, I pray thee, if I have found favor in your sight, let me know your ways, that I may know you. So that I may find favor in your sight, consider, too, that this nation, it is your people. And he said, my presence shall go with you, and I will give you rest. And then he said, if your presence does not go with us, then don't lead us up from here. For how then can it be known that I have found favor in your sight, I and your people? Is it not by your going with us, so that I and your people may be distinguished from all other people who are on the face of the earth? And the Lord said to Moses, I will do all this thing of which you have spoken, for you have found favor in my sight, and I have known you by name. And then Moses said, I pray, show me your glory. And then we have the incident where God says, well, I can't show you all my glory, but I'll make all my goodness pass before you, which... what that ended up entailing, if God's goodness is a sense of well-being and happiness, I would say, I think that he provided something to Moses that Moses needed. Moses needed a sense of well-being, contentment, and happiness that he wasn't going to get leading the people of Israel. He would be a frustrated leader if that were the case. But it's because at the first part of this, in chapter 33, God says, oh, you're going to go up, but I'm not going up with you. And now Moses is essentially at the end of this saying, listen, you're the one that brought him out. And you've set me as the leader, but we're not going if you don't go with us. Which I think, again, is even this, again, produces a test for Moses. To not only now that, first of all, God says, well, I'll destroy the people and start over with you. Moses goes, no, don't do that. Now God goes, well, you guys go up, but I'm not going with you. And I think, again, Moses is saying, this isn't going to happen without you. I can't lead them without you. And I think also, again... it's an opportunity for Moses to say, not only do I not want you to destroy the people, but I also, here in this chapter, I don't want to lead them if you're not the one that's doing it. I don't want to be a human leader, which I can relate to. You know, as a pastor, I watch what other churches do. I look at other things that churches are employing. In fact, I listened to a pastor today of a church where Katie used to go to church when she was in college. And I was listening to that pastor speaking, and he was talking about that. They'd been on vacation, and they went to several churches, and he says, you got all these churches. This church is doing this, and this church is doing this, and this church is doing this. And he says, you know, you could put all that stuff. And he says, and those churches are packing those places out. But he says, I sit there, and he says, and then they don't say anything. There's no substance for the people, what they're giving them. He says, so they're drawing them in with all this other stuff. But they're not doing it God's way. They're using human world techniques to bring people in, and then they're not giving him anything from God, or very little from God, as he put it. And I'm like that. I go through that at times. I scratch my head and going, God, we've been here 20-some years, and we as a church always just kind of seem to be about the same. We just kind of, a little fluctuation back and forth, but it just, like, you know, and I'm going. And so I'm going, maybe, it's so once in a while I get kind of weird in the head, and I'll start thinking, maybe we ought to be doing different stuff. Maybe there's other things we ought to employ. Maybe we ought to try this. And then I'm going, you know what? I don't want to do anything if God clearly isn't leading in this. Because I like Moses, I don't want to be the leader. I don't want to be the leader of this church. I want God to be the leader of this church. I just want to be somebody he's using to help in the leadership. But I don't want to be the person that's out in front saying, we're going to do this. I want God to be the one saying, this is what we're going to do. And I can really relate to what Moses is saying here about, if I lead these people up and there's success, well, then that success falls on my shoulders. But I don't want that to be on my shoulders. If anything succeeds in this church, I want God to get the credit for it. I don't want to get the credit for it. Because I know for a fact anything I would do that I'd get credit for wouldn't be worth getting credit for in the end. We could pack our church out with a whole bunch of terrorists, maybe. Or we could pack our church out with a whole bunch of Christians, but just a bunch of Christians that are all just here to do religious stuff. I don't know. Anyway, you got the example. I'm beating a dead horse, maybe, or something. But just trying to illustrate this, that I think both of these situations, both these chapters back to back, both of them are tests for Moses to demonstrate his character. That he wants God to be faithful to his people, number one, and he wants God to be faithful to him, and God being the one that leads. And what's interesting enough, when we say God's not going to go with you, and he says, if we're not going to do this, if God doesn't go, remember, how is God doing this? The cloud and the pillar of fire. This wasn't some intangible, spooky God's with us thing. They knew God was there. They could watch that cloud take up, and they knew it was time to go. And it was as though God saying, this cloud's staying here, but you guys are going to leave. And Moses goes, we're not doing that. We're only going to go if you go up. If you take up, if that cloud takes up and moves, then we'll do it. In fact, it even kind of indicates that in the verses between where Ben was reading and where I picked up, because it talks about the tent that they put and how the cloud moved over it, and the cloud would come down and Moses would talk with God, and how this went, and how the people really knew that God was there, and that God was actually coming. I mean, could you imagine if every time you watched me walk in the building, there was a cloud that hovered over the building, that cloud descended? People would go, what's going on in there? And then I'd leave, and the cloud would go back up. People would pay attention. And that's what Moses doesn't want to happen. So, I still think in the end, when we're looking at this from a human point of view, we don't have omniscience to know how people are going to respond or how a thing is going to turn out. We do have to kind of test things. God does know how Moses is going to do, but he gives Moses concrete examples to demonstrate for our sake and for the sake of the rest of the people of Israel. Moses is really my guy. This is going to happen again. Not in Exodus, remember? There's going to be a man, Korah, that's going to come up and it's going, who is this guy that he should be leading us? We're going to lead the people. Moses is going, okay, let's have a test. And remember in the test, they go up and they offer fire and the earth opens up and Korah and his family go alive down into Hades or Sheol. So it's not, and it's, so this is not the last time that God's going to have to demonstrate Moses is my man. Because he's the one I've chosen, not because he was better than the rest of you. Although I think in some ways Moses did demonstrate, when he was doing some of these things, he did demonstrate better character. He really demonstrated, shall we say, a real positive zeal for the character of God. He wanted God to be honored. Okay.
And I think what I see, and I totally agree with that, what I see out of like stories like this is that people think that Moses changed the plan of God. And I'm talking about Christians too here. I'm not talking about some weirdos. And so what they do is they kind of extrapolate that and they put it into their present tense relationship with God. And you know, he has been around people who say, like, you know, let's pray for the favor of God in something. And I get where they're getting it. They're looking at these stories and they're seeing how Moses found favor. You know, these people are finding favor with God because of the way they're living. And you see God going, I'm not sure how I'm going to respond to it. And them saying, please do this. And they go, okay. You know, how about 50 people? How about 40? How about 30? Okay, for 30, well. And so I don't know. It's like I appreciate them trying to direct faith and be like, hey, you know what? If we come before our God, he's powerful enough to do that which is according to his will, and you know, maybe this is according to his will. Same time, I don't want it to be not our current model for how we should communicate. But
say the last thing you said there. I'm just trying to.
I appreciate people that pray in faith. Like let's come before God and expect great things to happen. You know. Not just saying our church family here.
Sure.
And not necessarily talking about charismatic churches, although you may see more of that there. But, you know, it's like with the Partnership for Transformation, we're kind of exiting out of that partnership that we've had for quite a while for a number of reasons, mainly logistics and funding. You know, we've had that partnership since 2003 or 2004, and it's just tough to keep it going. But, you know, as we transition out, there's Jeff, Wyndham, Bart, myself, and Patrick are kind of the guys that have been somewhat involved in it. And just second, sweets. And Patrick, he's like, let's just pray for God's favor on these people. And that's how they talk, you know. It's a little bit more Old Testament-ish in prayer. But I get what he's saying. He's like, hey, let's pray that God would continue to do something even after we pulled out. And it's like this kind of a prayer. It's like, you know, we can't do it. You're the only one that can do it. I'm not sure what you want to do on it, but would you do this? And so anyways, what I'm saying, you have to repeat. I don't want to, I want to have my current form of communication with God biblical and not modeled after Old Testament, although I see a certain measure of faith in the Old Testament. But I don't know if it's always obviously the model that I'm supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know if I'm making sense. But
no, I think so.
I just would say, some people would say, I agree with everything you guys are saying, but I'm also seeing that Moses kind of turned God's will. He didn't want to go with him. And Moses said, God, I can't do without you. All right, I'll go with you. And I don't know if I would... I guess I'd disagree in that. I know man doesn't bend God. It doesn't change God's mind. But here you can see God goes, all right, I'll go with you. So, I don't know. I just don't know how to respond to somebody that was really adamant about just reading the text verbatim and going, what happened in the text?
And that brings us to, if you go to 1 Samuel, because I want to look at this statement in 1 Samuel here, because we have, and we'll finish with these, and I don't have everything in 1 Samuel 15 marked down. I have 1 Samuel 15, 29, but I also want to look at 1 Samuel 15, 10. Because we have two, interestingly, I have two statements that are made over here, and they're going to relate to this, because this is what we're... we'll read the text and we'll see what it says. This is a context where Saul has disobeyed what God had set for him to do. And so verse 10 of 1 Samuel 15, and the word of the Lord came to Samuel saying, I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me and has not carried out my commands. And Samuel was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night. So all night he's trying to, I think he's crying out all night, trying to persuade God to change his decision here about rejecting Saul. And if you look down, let's go to verse 24. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned. I have indeed transgressed the command of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and listened to their voice. Now, therefore, please pardon my sin, return with me, that I may worship the Lord. And Samuel said to Saul, I will not return with you, for you have rejected the word of the Lord, and the Lord has rejected you from being king over Israel. And as Samuel turned to go, Saul seized the edge of his robe, and it tore. And then Saul said to David, then Saul...
Samuel said to him.
Did I turn the wrong page?
Yes.
Which verse do you have?
28.
I turned a whole extra page where it says, and Saul said to David, that's not my problem. Okay, verse 28. So Samuel said to him, the Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you today and has given it to your neighbor who is better than you. And also the glory of the Lord will not lie or change his mind. Now, we'll keep going. For he is not a man that he should change his mind. Now, the words change his mind, twice in verse 29, is the same word that's used back in verse 11 that says, I regret.
He should have regret.
It's the same word.
What words? Sorry, say that
again. In verse 29, it says, also the glory of Israel will not lie or change his mind, for he is not a man that he should change his mind. Does your Bible say change his mind? And that is the same expression that's used in verse 11 when it says, I regret that I have made Saul king. Now, I don't know, is that what you have in there? Now, in the Hebrew, that's the same. I agree. It's the same verb in the Hebrew. it's interesting, here we've got a passage in the same context, really about the same issue, about God rejecting Saul. And then once he's rejected Saul, he's not going to take Saul back, in which he says in verse 11, I regret or I have changed my mind that I made Saul king. And in verse 29, he says, God would, and actually the truth is, will not lie or change his mind. Lie seemed to be, he said it and then goes back on it. In other words, doesn't really do what he really said he's going to do. What's happening here? Does God change his mind or doesn't he change his mind? Well, I think verse 29 is telling you he doesn't change his mind like a man changes his mind. God appears to us from things that he says at different times, such as the situation we had last week that we looked at in Genesis 6, where God says, I regret that I have created man, beast, and animal, and he goes through all those different other things. Regret that I've created them upon the face of the earth. Same language. And so I'm going to destroy them. Well, then we looked at a couple passages in Exodus tonight in which he says something to Moses. Moses pleads with him, and God appears. Just honestly, I mean, if you just read this account and you didn't know anything else about God, if all you were doing was reading Exodus 32 and 33, you'd read those and go, well, God was going to do this, and Moses changed his mind. I mean, that'd be the natural reading. But the thing is we have more scripture than Exodus 32 and 33. Yeah. And we have to really, when we're talking about God, we have to bring all these scriptures to bear. And I believe verse 29 is one of the verses that actually gives us some bearing on understanding God. That there are things that God does within his plan that from our human point of view appears to be a change of mind. But God doesn't really change his mind in the way that we do. And I would say verse 29 is really the one that really defines it. We would say God to us appears to change his mind because he's going down this path. And then the path appears to go this direction. Saul, oh, now not Saul, but David. Okay. Changes his mind. Well, from our point of view, it does. Now, had God unscrolled his plan ahead of time, then we would have been able to see, oh, God had this point, and then he was going this way, and then this way. But from our point of view, it looked as though he's changing his mind. And in fact, he even says, I regret. He actually uses the terminology. I've changed my mind about Saul from making him king. Now, the thing is, and very honestly, this one of the situations, either First Timothy, 1 Samuel 15:11 is true, or 1 Samuel 15:29 is true, if they're both talking about the same type of change in your mind. They both can't be true. It can't be that God doesn't change his mind and yet he does change his mind. You can't have both of them be true at the same time. So we come to this place where we're talking about the doctrine of God in this, and we have to answer this question. Does God change his mind or doesn't he? Well, we've got other verses that would tell us, and turn over to the book of Hebrews, and there's a promise that's made to us in Hebrews chapter 6. Hebrews chapter 6, and he's making a reference back to a promise that God swore to Abraham. Verse 13, it says, for when God made the promise to Abraham, since he could swear by no one greater, he swore by himself, saying, I will surely bless you and I will surely multiply you. And thus, having patiently waited, he obtained the promise. For men swear by one greater, and with an oath, the confirmation is an end of all argument or disputation. In the same way, then, God desiring even more to show to the heirs of promise the unchangeableness of his purpose. In other words, he wanted us to get it. He wanted the heirs to so get the fact that God's promise would not change, period. He said, in order that he imposed with an oath, he swore an oath. God doesn't have to swear an oath. If God says, I'm going to do this, that's all we need. We don't need God to stand there and go, I swear. I swear on a stack of Bibles. Cross my heart, hope die, poke a needle in my eye, as we used to say when I was a kid. God doesn't have to do that. God just has to say, I'm not going to, or I am going to. But then he says in verse 18, in order that by two unchangeable things, and a lot of people get stuck on this because they're always going, I want the two unchangeable things. And we read that by two unchangeable things, in which it is impossible for God to lie. We have a strong, and everybody goes, what's the other unchangeable thing? The other unchangeable thing was he swore an oath. He already have that. That he swore an oath. But the thing that even makes it even more unchangeable is the second thing that's added in verse 18. It's impossible for God to lie. God never really lies. So when God was making those statements to Moses, God could not have been lying. God really, in those situations, had to be asking, putting Moses in a situation where, and I would look at it, this way. Within God's plan, there was the potential that God could have destroyed the nation of Israel and could have started over with Moses. And it still would have been descendants of Abraham. It wouldn't have altered anything. With the exception of the fact that Moses was only one of the families of Israel, and God had really made promises in one sense to all 12 of those sons. He did that towards the end of the book of Genesis through their father Israel, through Jacob. So there's one sense in which God could have done this, but another sense in which God had already made promises over here that he really needed to keep. Not just to Israel in a general sense, but to the 12 sons. And so we look at those and we'd say, God makes this statement, and he really could go that way. It would not have, in many ways, would not really have violated what God was saying. But it really served ultimately then to be a test of Moses to see, does Moses really count my promises to my people to be something? Is Moses really concerned about what I promised because he's concerned about my character? And the second one, is Moses really think he can lead these people? Or is Moses realize he can't do this without me? And does he know that? And does everybody else get that? So that when you come to 1 Samuel in a similar term, who did God ultimately want to rule Israel? David. We could go back to the book of Genesis, those promises to those 12 sons of Israel that he says of Judah, the scepter shall not depart from Israel. So God had made the promise, trying to think, about 900 years earlier, when they were down there in Egypt, he'd made that promise to Judah. The promise has to be kept to David. But he starts with Saul. Why does he start with Saul and doesn't immediately start with David? I think perhaps to show, and God did choose him. I always grew up in Sunday school being taught Saul was the people's king. David was God's king. It doesn't say that when you read the text. If you read the text, God sends Samuel out to get Saul. And Saul is not interested in being king, remember? Saul's hiding out. He's a little, even though he's a whole head taller than almost everybody else that he lives among, which meant he was a real tall guy compared to everybody else. He was still, his knees were knocking. He was a little bit timid at the time. But God made him king, and he became a powerful king and became a warrior. And he did some things and God changed his heart, the scripture said, and he did some things that were honoring to God, but he also didn't obey everything of God. And in the end, God ends up choosing David, I really believe, for the fact of what he has to tell Samuel when Samuel looks at all David's brothers. You people look on the outside. And Saul was that kind of a guy. He was tall. Who else? Do you want to pick a short guy to be your king? You want a Napoleon to be a king? Now, Napoleon was a great emperor from some people's point of view. But normally you would not pick that little short guy. Normally you'd pick a big, tall, strapping, strong guy to lead the people. And that's what he chose with Saul, and he made Saul a king. But it comes down to David, and he says, I want a king where I'm looking at his heart. I'm going to look at the inside, and that's the king I'm going to choose. And so I believe in this context, God changes his mind from a human point of view. God ultimately, in his plan, was going to David. We know that because you can go back to Genesis, and you can establish that fact. So when it tells us he changes his mind in here, that really is from our point of view, in the fact that he chose Saul And Saul really demonstrated himself to not be dependable in the end, to do what God ultimately wanted him to do. And in that, God says, I've changed my mind now from him. We're changing course. But I don't change my mind like you guys do. You change your mind because, well, I was going to go do this today, but it's kind of stormy outside. I don't think I'm going to go do that. I'm going to stay inside. I don't want to get wet, you know. We change our minds like that. God doesn't change his mind like that. And I think that's the point. And that's what we're trying to demonstrate because, and so I'm trying to help you see, we look at Arminians and we think they teach you can lose your salvation. And, well, these guys are all crazy and they just must not read their Bibles right. But granted, we're just trying to show you, and I'm giving you one interpretation, and it may not even always be the best interpretation on these, but I'm trying to show you, they do have scriptures that they used to say, things change. God changes. God changes his mind. And I'm not trying to persuade you to their position by any means. We're really trying to demonstrate some faults in there, because they don't really square like this whole idea we're talking about. Does God lie or doesn't God lie? Does God change his mind or does he not change his mind? They don't... They're trying to come up with this, and in the process, they press sometimes scriptures to their advantage to try to say God doesn't necessarily know everything, or God doesn't exercise full control, because if he did, then they would be pressed to the point of having to say, well, yeah, how could those people lose their salvation? But see, they don't want to go that route, because then they're going to look at other scriptures, which we will eventually look at, that do seem to say or present the fact that a person could lose their salvation.
Hey,
yes.
I just want to see if this is right. So just listening to the scenarios and things, and is this, you didn't exactly say this, but I've heard it taught or whatever, that God has a permissive will and he has a desirous will. And he's got like these perimeters or whatever, and he has a purpose. He sees the whole picture. And within that, from his perspective, there's different ways that things can go to serve his purpose or whatever. And in these situations, it may be, you know, depending on how, let's say, Moses deals with God in the circumstance, his attitude or, you know, whatever, then his test and how he deals with it, then God will go with, you know, permit it to be this certain way, but if Moses went a different way, he would permit it a different way, depending on how Moses did it. And it has to do with his overall plan and his desires. I'm trying to understand how these fit in with between a desirous will and what he would permit and his boundaries. So I'm not sure how that all fits in with it.
That's really the idea of God's determinative will and God's permissive will really kind of comes out of this view that we were looking at of God tonight, that God, there's just things, God has an overall plan, but there's a lot of things within his overall plan God has not, you know, this goes this way, this goes this way, this goes this way. God hasn't really determined things one way or another. He just kind of lets them. And the thing is in reality, the scriptures seem to indicate, and we've got other verses, and I'm not going to spend... We're not going to go into them now, but I've got other verses that we're going to be looking at that are going to tell us that God really does work things according to his plan. And sometimes in detail, that things that he's planned out. So I think we have to be a little careful sometimes when we say that's God's permissive will. Because it's like God's permissive will is easier. It's a way that we try to, how would you put it? It's a way that we try to say, you know, sometimes God, things happen down here that do not seem very good. So that couldn't have been what God wanted, but it had to be something God permitted. Adam and Eve. Did God want them to sin? See, that's what we all say. God did not want them to sin. But the thing is, you have to say, but somewhere or another, God wanted to provide salvation and demonstrate some things about his character. And how could that happen if they weren't in that state? See, so we're kind of caught in a quandary. In other words, let's put it this way. We're left with some things that I can't answer. Because, and you've got theologians and philosophers that have spilt tons of ink and filled tons of paper trying to answer this question. And the thing is sometimes we're trying to answer a question that God hasn't explained to us. How he can incorporate evil, as we see it, or sin, in his purpose and his plan, with being righteous and without wanting people to sin. How does he do that? Just permits? Okay, that's what we say. He permits it. But the thing is, we don't really have a word that, for the most part, that says God permits this to go on his permissive will. That's really kind of a theological designation. About the closest you come to is a statement that Paul makes over in Acts where he says that God permitted or allowed the Gentiles just to go their own way. And yet in reality, he says later on in the book of Acts, but God was setting their boundaries. He said how long those nations would be there and how far they could expand. So he really wasn't just totally letting them go their own way. But there were boundaries. So, I let's put it this way. I used to spend a lot of time. In fact, I was asked this question a year ago by a friend of mine, and I spent days working on trying to answer this question. I have worked on answering this question many times, and it's and I don't have an answer to it. How you put it all together? Because I don't. I honestly, because I've looked at it, I've worked on it, I've read a lot of different theologians to see if there are other scriptures that I haven't brought to bear on this, and it. About the time I think I've got it figured out, then I come across some other things. So I don't know how you square that. And this my question is I don't know in the end that that's what our job is to do down here, is to figure out how God worked his plan out. That's just my view on it. So.
One of the things he does tell us in Ephesians is that we were chosen in Christ before the foundation of the world to be holy and blameless before him. And so you could ask the question, if he chose us to be blameless, how come he doesn't just snap his finger and make us blameless? Because for whatever his reason, it pleased him to allow us to be active participants in that process. And so as being active participants in that process, he orchestrates things in time that sometimes might seem to us to go against his ultimate purpose, but it's because he knows exactly what we need as individuals to get us thinking correctly, to get us acting correctly. And so he allows things to come into our life that appear contrary to that. Why does he allow me to be tempted to do this really bad thing? God says he can't tempt us to evil, and yet he allows us to be tempted. Isn't that contrary to his purpose? No, because he's allowing me to grow to the point where he knows exactly what I need to develop my thinking to help begin making right choices.
Would that be like Moses with it brings out in the scripture how Moses kind of, you know, I don't know if you could say, argues with God about, you know, no, don't destroy the people. You know, it's that kind of thing. If that situation wouldn't have come up like that, then Moses wouldn't have gotten to that mind. And so it brought that out in him, I guess.
So it's for Moses' benefit, not for God's benefit.
Right.
No, that's a good example. That's a good example. And you have a lot of those. You have the one in Philippians 2 says, God works in us to do these things, but I'm the one that provides the choice. I choose whether I'm going to participate in it. You know, and it's very plain from Hebrews that not everybody cooperates in God's will. So there's some people that God chastens, and there's some people that he chastens, that he scourges and brings them home. You know, so
goes so far as to give desire and the energy to do it. So it's not like he's throwing us out to dry, hanging us out to dry. He gives us everything necessary to do it, except we got to make the mental choice to cooperate with it. But he even works in that to make us willing to do as well, like sending out the hornets.
Yeah.
Makes us willing to go without tweaking our mind, making us to go. But still, yeah, it's one of those things, trying to understand the mind of God from a human perspective is
I think there's a comfort and assurance that we have in knowing that God's planned things, and that things are not just going. How am I trying to say? It's not just a roll of the dice out there. It's not you roll the dice, you take your turn, you roll your dice, and we just kind of see how it all happens. It's not like that. God actually has a more minute control over things than that. But there, he does allow his creatures to exercise some freedom. And how he incorporates that, again, that's that he... I can't do it, but then I'm a finite being with a finite mind, and I'm trying to wrap my mind around scriptures like we were looking at tonight that that in trying to just present at least a possible way of answering this, other than just to say that God's purely at our mercy in getting his plan done. So.
Some things we have to just acknowledge that are true about God, even if we don't understand it. So.
Yeah.
Isn't some of this that God was going to know how Moses, because he knows everything, and he knows Moses' heart or whatever, and he knew how Moses would respond. And so it's kind of like he already knew how Moses would respond to the test, but...
The statement still made, though, that he had regrets and he changed his mind, so you can't... It's not like God wasn't making a genuine offer there. If he wasn't making a genuine offer, he couldn't come back and say, I changed my mind. Otherwise, he would have been no genuine offer there.
You've got, I mean, we could sit here and I could give you things back and forth from one side of this to the other, and we're going to look at scriptures that will go over some of these, but one of the ones that, and I don't know if it's in this list, I can't remember, because I've looked at it recently, and I don't remember when, but Hezekiah, remember he got sick and he was going to die, and then he went and cried out to God, and God extended his life out, what, 15 more years? Well, we go to other scriptures and say, well, God's determined the length of your days. So, you know, what I was always taught in seminary is God has the length of your days written out here in terms of what you potentially could reach as an individual, but out of disobedience. And I did was looking at the account with Hezekiah, and I think that there is a basis, and Hezekiah was sick because of something he did. And I think it's in this, because I know I was looking at it for one of our studies, and I can't remember which one it was, but that it's because of that. And when Hezekiah repented and changed his mind, then God let him live out, I would say, the full length of those days. Somehow within God's plan, God put that together. Was the shorter life what God wrote down, or was the longer life? Well, obviously we'd have to say longer life, because that's what he lived out. If he wouldn't have repented when he died shorter, was that the number that God originally wrote down for him? See, those are the questions you have to ask. You're going to fill out the length of your days? I would say that's true. But is there the caveat with that, that perhaps if you were disobedient to God, maybe you won't see the full length of those days? Is that possible? I would say maybe that's possible. So, well, let's close with a word of prayer here. We'll sit in there and talk some more. Father, we're thankful that we can know you are a good God. We can know that you are all-powerful and all-knowing in your plan. Sometimes there's things in your Bible, in your Word, that when we read them, we're left kind of not fully understanding everything there is to understand about you, but that's not surprising. You're an infinite God and we're finite beings. And we look forward to the day coming in which we will actually get to know you even better when your Son comes for us and we're in your presence. And I ask that you might encourage us in the time together here. Amen.